Well, Barbara Ann, Tony, and Brandon, I think that was extraordinarily helpful. Why don't I turn it over, Mr. Chairman, to you or others that have questions, and I'll have some of my own as well.
Thank you, Steve. To go to the last one first, I think it's important and useful to know that we do reevaluate the forms, the inspection forms and the materials we employ in inspections. And I take it that one of the things that may be useful is if you're suggesting in the basic formatting of an inspection, if some careful attention be given to areas where the inspection team finds what it thinks may have been an issue of standard application or misinterpretation of the statute, of the standard. And I think that's something that that the people behind me in Helen Muncher's division are giving a lot of thought to now. But with respect to the first one, the big one, of the ongoing study, and I very much appreciate the focus you've given it, Brandon and Tony. Is it the group's sense that we ought to hit certain of the instances? For example, mention was made of the Citicorp letter from the OCC. I mean, not to seize on that, but is it your suggestion that we take some of the major examples, and when you say determine what happened on the ground, try to go into this from an audit inspection review of an audit issue? Is that your recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have to be a part of what would happen. We have, you know, to pick a few examples and really dig in to find out. And I think, I mean, we're assuming that some of what you will find will have to do with things that aren't directly within the purview of the PCAOB. For example, you may find that in some areas what you see is a problem, you know, a fundamental problem with the accounting standards. But I would say, you know, similar to what Brandon was saying, that rather than just sort of set that aside as not in your purview, one of the things I would hope that this board would look at is whether the standards are not auditable. So, but to your main point, yes, I would think focusing in on, you know, maybe what, half a dozen or whatever, you know, cases to see what happened, you know, really dig into the details of, you know, what went wrong or what, you know, didn't go wrong, but nonetheless that led to the conclusion that it did. But also to look, you know, sort of more big picture in some of the ways that the Europeans are doing it, at some of these issues about culture and incentives and independence and skepticism and, you know, that are broader than the individual case analysis. But I think one of the reasons we've called for a specific in-depth study is that we think we know some things about what went wrong, but we don't know what we don't know. And we don't know a lot about why. And so I think those are some of the answers we'd like to get to.
And in the process, we may find examples. There may be information that comes to us that indicates a breakdown of basic governance models that we all agree on, a tipping point when communications cease to go to the audit committee, a studied diversion of attention from what the activities of a subsidiary were or what a unit were. Those are things we would normally bring to the attention of the commission, and I guess what you're suggesting is that if we do have a study like that, that might be the way to give appropriate publicity and attention to them. 21A reports, I think, are still done at the commission, and that might lead. You're urging us to keep, as we go into these situations case by case, to keep the blinders off and think about what might make the appropriate substance of a Commission 21A report on a broader front, and I think that's a very helpful thing. I did want to get back to Ann's emphasis on the green paper, and I appreciate the irony of your remarks about their not being modest, they're being ambitious. Not to describe them as either utopian or Orwellian, it did seem to me that as you went through the list, you went through issues that were being raised by them that had a particularly continental flavor to them. And as you got more specific, you got more into the areas in which we could, as a board, proceed, as you said earlier, effectively and efficiently. And I want to be sure that that's a consensus that I'm discerning from what you're saying, that, in fact, appreciating the boldness of raising the question of whether firms are too big to fail and whether they ought to be broken up and whether someone ought to do the audit besides private firms, all of which are in the list. Is it a matter of recognition that our role should get to how we affect the conduct of auditors in this financial crisis, where they may be seen or perceived to have suspended skepticism, or where they may have interpreted their rules on the application of GAAP as not to require a broader horizon on what was going on, and therefore dealing with what the auditor's report is, dealing with what can be audited under the standards and what we do audit, dealing with how the audit firm relationship works with the audit committee. Are we, in your view, going down the right track by hitting those issues and not dealing with whether firms should be corporations, whether they should be broken up by an economic regulatory authority?
Well, that's difficult because you want to be practical.
Yes.
But I think if we don't have some space to actually talk about the structure of the audit industry, we won't actually be able to grapple with issues like independence. It's very tough. It may be that one way to go here is that if the European Commission has actually set the debate running about, because they've got the same big four. I mean, it's the same big four that the European Commission are looking at, that the same big four that would be here. So it may be that one decision your group could take is to say, let's see what the Commission comes out with later in 2011. We might return to that question of the structure of the audit industry. Meanwhile, we can get on with some very specific work that related to the US market and make progress. But I think I think these are interconnected.
You believe they're interconnected?
I believe they are, yes.
Can I add one point on that? You know, I guess what I would assume, I'm generally comfortable with what you're saying about what you think the focus should be. If, as a result of your fact-finding, you discover that there are certain things about the structures and governance and whatnot of the audit firms that's directly related to the reasons we're having problems with lack of professional skepticism or lack of independence, then I think those issues come back, you know, back into play. I also think it's a separate issue, perhaps, but I don't know whether the audit firms are a systemic risk. They are clearly too big to fail. And what does that mean in terms of the willingness or ability to take, you know, tough enforcement actions against them? And does that play into an environment in which the audit firms feel that they are sort of insulated from accountability when they do fail? So I think to the degree that you look at some of those bigger structural issues, it ought to be driven by what you find once you go in and do the spade work and find out what went wrong.
I think that's very wise, and I take it to heart. I'm fond of asking whether anybody can give me an example of a major firm that failed through private civil enforcement, or through regulatory civil enforcement action. I mean, it seems to me that that our job is not to worry about the collateral effects of regulatory civil enforcement, but to decide what has to be enforced. But I think these are all very stimulating and well put.
Tony, wanted to circle back. This is Jay Hansen. Circle back to one of the things you said, and you mentioned this arcane reference to SOP 94-6, which was the translation for the non-accountants in the room, as this is a standard that was issued back in 1994 that effectively said companies should disclose more about the risks and uncertainties of their operations and the estimates and the financial statements. And your point about does that need to be revisited, that's another a fundamental question of, well, is there something wrong with the standard or is there something wrong with the application? And another poster child example that my chairman, Mr. Doty, and I have talked about, and Mr. Croker has been on the stump talking about this, is disclosure about litigation. That there's a principle that's been out there since FASB number 5, so back in the early 70s, has been out there that says if you've got litigation exposure or contingency exposure that has not been accrued for in the financial statements, I don't know, remember the exact words, but it's effectively disclose some stuff about it that will give the reader some idea of how big of an issue it could be. And the FASB has taken a couple different bites at an apple of trying to say, well, it's not working right now today with disclose some stuff, and so here's 10 pages of granular things to disclose. And well-meaning lawyers like Mr. Doty say, no, you can't do that because that will compromise the case and everything else. And Jim, I think the current discussions at some of the recent conferences and communications to the issuers are you need to disclose more stuff. We'll back off on the standard for now, but if we have to put in the standard to be more granular, we'll do that. But it's kind of a poster child example of the challenge of trying to mandate exactly what a company should disclose, and you get what we have today, which was hundreds of pages of footnotes that investors have a hard time wading through to figure out, well, what's important here? It can't all be of equal importance, but it might actually comply with the requirements, but it really doesn't tell the story. And it's one of the challenges that issuers face and auditors face and we face as we're inspecting to say, do the financial statements really tell the story? And there's a lot of players involved in fixing that problem, and I'm not sure that we can do it by ourselves. But Tony, back to maybe the question that I want to frame up here: Do you think there's really a problem with the standards? Is it really an application of the standards on some of these softer areas that the investors clearly want more information?
Jay, I do believe that there are areas where there's a problem with the standards. I also agree with you with respect to 94-6. On the disclosure of significant risks and uncertainties. I think that standard, and I remember spending a lot of time when it was being developed and working with some people on it as well, and it had all the signs and indicators of being a good standard. It has unfortunately not resulted in the kind of information that we would need. So that one clearly appears to be an issue of how it's applied and what we're missing in the implementation. But on the other hand, I don't think that – I'm not ready to say that there isn't an issue to look at in terms of how audits are performed and so on. And what I wanted to also mention, FAS 5, by the way, is also an excellent example, because if you read it and what it says about the probability of when you have to provide disclosures and how it's actually applied, you see two different worlds. And I don't care who's responsible for making those two worlds the way they are. The problem is that, which is why I said I don't. My point is that as an investor, I always find that I get information about liabilities and those kinds of risks later than I would want it. To go back to one more just brief comment, Jim, you had asked a question that Barbara and Anne have certainly responded to very well, but I just wanted to point out that I cannot think of a more critical study where the design is going to be more important. So when you were talking about how one should go about it, I think it's the design that's going to be fundamentally critical to how this gets done. And I think what Jay has been saying contributes to that. So I think it's critical that we're very careful about how this is designed and the questions you ask yourself as you proceed through it, through this particular study. The other thing that I want to be very clear about is I see a lot of studies. I see a lot of announcements. Unfortunately, the follow-through is rarely something worth writing home about. For example, the Europeans have looked at their banks, but I think that if you just simply look at the amount of information that's missing in the stress tests, it's unfortunate. Because I don't think it gives you, as an investor, it does not help me and does not make me comfortable with respect to the banks in France and Germany when they tell me that their own regulators are permitting them not to provide. And by the way, I don't mean to single out those. We do the same thing around here at different levels. The point, though, is that I think the study needs to be designed carefully and carried through very, very carefully as well.
I'd like to come back to something that Barbara said about the firms and too big to fail. I would hope that this board would never view these firms as too big to fail, that in fact, if the firms had got in trouble in the marketplace and weren't living up to their obligations and as a result faced a dilemma that would cause the demise of one, I do think you ought to let the private sector work then and let the firm fail. I think it's very wrongful for the government to support inefficient and ineffective organizations, and so I would hope that people wouldn't on this board view these as too big to fail. I would also hope that the board would not wait for the EC to do something. I would hope that this board would be very proactive and try to get ahead of the ball game rather than just following what the EC has done. The EC at times over the years has talked a great story at the beginning and then not really delivered. And if you're waiting for that, I think you'd be wasting and getting behind time. On the professional skepticism issue, I've been in this profession for 3.5 decades now. And every single decade, there's been some event occur, or a number of events occur, where questions have given rise to the question of why weren't the auditors more skeptical. It certainly gives rise to the question of whether or not the fundamental issue is not whether they were skeptical, but whether they were really, truly independent. And I think we'll talk about that after lunch today. But besides dealing with the independence issue, which I think you have to deal with, I think you also have to understand that the number one vehicle for dealing with the lack of skepticism is to hold the auditor accountable. And that is done through your enforcement arm. And I know we have to wait to see what happens, but we've been waiting 9 years now to see what happens. And I think that's long enough. I think it's fair for the public now to actually see something come out, but I think nothing would influence auditors in the field more than seeing some auditors who didn't live up to their professional obligations hit with some steep penalties, if you will. And I think that degree of accountability needs to be forthcoming. If you continue and if the public continues to see coming out of this board a lack of meaningful enforcement actions, a real watchdog with teeth, then I think it's realistic to expect that auditors will behave accordingly and view the watchdog agency not so much as a watchdog but as a lapdog. It's just the way people behave. So I think a lot of that is up to the board to drive the behavior and what happens there. On the issue of the standards, first of all, there is a piece of this that falls into the three plates between the FASB, the SEC, and the PCLB. But having said that, though, I don't think the PCLB should be sitting there and saying, we got to wait for the other people before we can do anything. I think you divide the three pieces up, but then once the pieces are determined, then I think the PCLB should move independently and aggressively, timely, quite frankly, to do something. We know, as we've talked about, the FASB is you know, we've been waiting since 1978 for that standard on unusual transactions. You know, we could all be dead before we ever see anything out of that board the way they operate. And likewise, on 94-6, that is truly a standard problem. I don't think anyone really thought that standard was going to work when initially was put out by ACSEC. If you look at the original exposure draft, it had a very good disclosure and a much lower benchmark for having to disclose risk and uncertainties. And then when the business community came in and vehemently opposed that, and of course there were hardly any investors on ACSEC at the time, ACSEC totally folded the tent, watered it way down, created a benchmark for disclosure that you'd almost have to have a nuclear plant going burning up before you'd have to disclose it. And so, in fact, in that standard, it is a deficiency in the standard. People have known about that deficiency for a long time, and yet, again, this is a standard where we've known about it and no one's ever acted on it. Now we've had a meltdown, and it's unfortunately that, you know, members in my fund have had to go through that exposure and the damage to their retirement accounts because some regulators couldn't get out of their way and get something done. So I'd certainly urge that the PCOB move forward actively on their piece of the project and not wait for the other people to go do their stuff, or, you know, we may be going through another meltdown before we ever see anything happen.
Bob, why don't we go from you right the way around the table to the cards that are up, and then if anybody has any more, we ought to be mindful and break for lunch no later than 12:45.
Thanks, Steve. Bob Tirola speaking. Barbara, you said some things that really, really struck me. The notion that auditors could be part of the systemic risk, too big to fail. The auditing profession globally has a public franchise that is unique, and it seems to me has to be more transparent about how it does business, how it's organized, how it conducts its professional responsibility. And I wanted to go back to what Jay was mentioning about these various arcane ways that accountants deal with issues. But much of what we do is try to assess the degree to which something out of our control will affect the numbers that are being published. And whether you're accounting for those numbers or auditing those numbers, it's largely factors that are outside of your control that you're trying to address. And what I'm hearing from those who represent investors more directly than I is that you want to know how you make those judgments. And that's a fair question. And in some way, in the reporting framework, and maybe it's an auditor discussion and analysis, those sort of questions can be addressed. But I agree with my colleagues here that that this is, despite the fact that the auditors seem to escape repercussions, they could have, and maybe should have, been the group in the financial reporting supply chain that raised these issues along the way.
Steve, thank you. This is Norman Harrison. I'll be very brief. Also a follow-up to a comment that Barbara made when she was responding to a question about the proposed scope of the study that the working group has recommended, when she made the observation that one of the issues here is we don't know what we don't know. It occurred to me that one of the questions that has troubled me as we've read the various postmortems on the subprime meltdown and all of the failures around those incidents is, I think there's a fair question to be asked in some cases, did the auditors not know what they didn't know? And what I mean by that is, you know, in your any study you undertake, in your ongoing examination activities, I think it's important to focus on what mechanisms the firms have in place to ensure that they have requisite subject matter expertise. I mean, everyone at this table is in one form or another an observer of or a participant in the capital markets. I think the subprime issues or perhaps a vivid illustration of the complexity with which financial products are structured these days and accounted for, the speed with which they move and the number of parties involved in complex structured transactions. And I often wonder whether in many cases the auditors, you know, to give the benefit of the doubt, may have been asking good questions or the right questions, but did they have the subject matter expertise in-house to evaluate the credibility of the responses they were receiving from the issuer? And so I think that's an aspect of this that can't be overlooked as we look for lessons learned or perhaps, you know, guidance to provide going forward about how to try to ensure that things like this don't happen again.
A brief comment about what Norman just said. Unfortunately, we all base a lot of our judgments on what we've learned from the past, and we know what we know from the past, but we don't know what we know about the future. And it's very possible that an estimate for a particular firm could have been a good estimate, yet they were financially crumbling underneath. We just don't know that. There were plenty of people before the crisis meltdown that were saying there is trouble ahead. You know, there's a disaster. At the same time, there were plenty of people that said it's smooth sailing. So we are subject to not knowing what we don't know. But I think giving more information to more people, i.e. investors, certainly helps more people process that. The AIG case to me is really quite interesting. It points to several difficulties. One is accounting standards themselves. You know, perhaps better discussion about off-balance sheet financing, perhaps better discussion about fair value pricing. Those would certainly help in information. It certainly sounds like there was a breakdown in applying auditing principles in the case of AIG. But even if everything were done correctly in 2008 or even 2007, it wasn't going to stop the global financial crisis freight train that was coming at us. That was well in place, and ultimately there were a lot of loans that basically defaulted. I think one way we might have been able to have at least mitigated some of the damage was greater information to investors throughout the entire process. If we had greater disclosure, we knew that there were greater risks associated with balance sheets, perhaps as early as 2003 and 04. We look back now, and it's quite clear that there was rot building in the system as early as 2003. If we had known that, the marketplace itself can send very strong signals and could have started to address some of these things before the bubble got to be the size that it did in real estate. And so, again, I go back to disclosure to investors, the audit report, or whether it's the ADNA. I think that would be a significant help in the whole process.
For purposes of the reassessment, I would urge the board to use its scarce fact-finding resources where those fact-finding resources can contribute to the debate in a meaningful manner, so that while I recognize the importance of some of the broader structural and other issues that have been raised on the continent, where I would hope that the board would focus on is trying, as Tony highlights, to design a study that can speak specifically to a process where we learn something at the end of the day. So purely as a thought example, not to suggest anything on a micro level, if you take Damon's observation from this morning about the extraordinary difficulty of valuing mortgage-backed securities and mortgage-related securities, and you took some of the examples Barbara gave, and you looked across, say, three different accounting firms, and then you looked at a firm that actually is viewed as successfully navigating the crisis, it would be an interesting question. How did four different auditing firms deal with that? You could come up with some comparables. You could look at how those comparables then played out through successive firm failures. You could compare and contrast that with facts on the ground about how the audits of successful firms dealt with that. My suspicion, my hypothesis going in, is that you would find that much of it was driven by the quality of the managements of those companies, much more so than the quality of the audits of those companies. But then you would develop a factual predicate that you could actually make some decisions on, and we would be smarter 18 months from now than where we are today. Because otherwise, I think that the facts will drift into the realm of competing mythologies and narratives by people with various stories to tell, and positions to advance, and that the board has unique opportunity to set a baseline for some factual assessments. And then I would use what are very limited resources to try and answer questions where at the end of your study you might actually know something more than when you went into your study, as opposed to repeating a more broadly based structural debates that are, will produce multiple white papers.
Judge?
The interesting thing here is that, while we had, say, General Motors and Chrysler, I think you could understand what happened there. But look at the what you had. You had all these financial institutions that had the problems. It was a financial institution meltdown. Now, that ought to tell you something. And I think what you looked, and you can see the type of security that was involved, the securitized security. It tells us that we had what I referred to as the smartest guys on the block are inventing things, and nobody knows what how to deal with them. We got things that are exploding without an antidote as to how to deal with them when they go bad. We're creating viruses in the system. And it seems to me that that we can there's a lot that we can tell just from how to deal with this thing. I mean, the critical thing is to find out how to prevent it from happening in the future. The failures, the oversights and whatnot. But there obviously is something in that's created in the financial institutions that's causing or that caused the auditors of those financial institutions difficulty in being able to grasp that problem, what it was, and to be able to deal with it. In other words, if it's like a disease or something, you could isolate the germ. You ought to be able to isolate it here. We ought to be able to, we know that we have a lot of cowboys around. We know we have a lot of lawyers around that are every day and are creating, you have somebody creating something called synthetic securities. What the hell are we talking about? How do you have synthetic securities? Where? And somebody's got to be saying, hey, you know, that can't happen. In my day, if we had some broker in Utah, in Salt Lake City, creating a synthetic security, you know where that person would have been? So there's certain things here that we can deal with, it seems to me. And to come critically and say, hey, wait a second, folks. Before we start creating these things that are going to destroy us, we ought to be able to test them to see what you need to be able to cope with them when they go out of control. And I think I really think a lot of the effort should be paid on how do we prevent this from happening. We keep looking to say, hey, what were the lessons learned? Yeah, but the lessons learned, it seems to me, that we're not a bunch of dummies. I think we can figure out what some of these were.
Barbara, do you want to get a word, and then the chairman, and then we'll break for lunch?
Yeah, I just wanted to make two final points. One, on the design of the study, I would encourage you to think of yourself as the average three-year-old. You know, why? 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 I mean, what is part of the problem, but why is, what we need to know if we're going to fix it? And the other thing is Brandon has said, and rightly so, is referred several times to the very limited resources. I would urge the SEC to approve a budget for this board that gives you more than very limited resources for this kind of inquiry.
Steve, thank you. These are extremely thoughtful comments. Very helpful. I wanted to leave one question for you all to think about over lunch. It's sort of the yang to Lin's yang about not being fixed on too big to fail or on some of these other issues. Let us suppose we do a well-designed focus study and we do come up with some structural or very significant changes in the practice of the audit, the audit profession, the industry, the way in which they can be addressed. And let's suppose also they are changes that have been around for a while and have been discussed over decades, but have never been the devil never having been worked out because they didn't have to be, the devil of the details. And let us suppose they're extremely expensive. Does it affect the view of this investor advisory group that, in fact, if the right things to do to restore objectivity and to enhance credibility in the audit and to make it something that investors can get meaningful information from and get comfort about the what stands behind it as in a test function, that is very expensive? Does it bother you, or where do you come out in terms of the valuation of what we do, the priorities? If we do things which make it much more expensive with the result that there are some companies or some aspirant issuers that can't do IPOs, can't afford the audit, and are essentially priced out of becoming public companies. Now, you may say, well, that's a draconian result. But let us suppose that the best changes are expensive changes. If you'll indulge that hypothesis with us, where do you come out on the value of or how we go about doing that? I'm going back to something Gus said about the tipping point. To avoid the tipping point in AIG is a big issue in the minds of this board. So how do we balance those competing costs of excellence, value for the investor, and cost to the registrant?
And then I'd like to leave you with the thought for the afternoon, and Lynn, for your group, potentially to think about and get any recommendations on what steps, if any, do you believe the PCAOB should take to, one, improve auditor objectivity, improve and boost the transparency of auditor skepticism, monitor conflicts of interest, Gus, which I know you spoke about at some length at the last session, and police auditor independence. And so with that, I think you got enough to think about for lunch, and we'll look forward to reconvening at 1:45.